My name is Sebastian Rose-Tamper. I'm the head of the Emergency Response Section in the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs based in Geneva. I'm also the Secretary of the International Search and Rescue Advisory Group.
That is one hell of a mouthful. Good morning. Welcome to London. Hey everybody, welcome back to the podcast. I was recently back down in London, and as you can hear, I spent some time with Sebastian from UN OCHA. Now, with its partners, OCHA contributes to principled and effective humanitarian response through coordination, advocacy, policy, information management, and humanitarian financing tools and services. OCHA's country and region offices are responsible for delivering the core functions in the field by leveraging functional expertise throughout the organization. OCHA has offices all over the world. Specialized and dedicated OCHA staff work to ensure the effective assistance reaches millions of humanitarian beneficiaries in four continents. As you were well aware in the media currently, there are so many emerging threats that are going on throughout the world. And as part of its global presence, which includes country and regional offices across the globe, OCHA supports IASC scale-up responses. Such responses are activated in the most complex and challenging humanitarian emergencies when the highest level of mobilization is required across the humanitarian system to ensure that the right capabilities and systems are placed effectively to meet the needs. Some of the current emergencies where these are currently deployed is in Afghanistan, where they've experienced 40 years of wars and recurrent natural disasters. Chronic poverty, drought, and COVID-19 pandemic have left more than 18 million people in Afghanistan in need of humanitarian assistance. You will also see their work happening in Ethiopia recently, where the acute food insecurity is affecting up to 7 million people, combined with the malnutrition and water shortages in pastoralist and agro-pastoralist southern and southeastern lowlands. Humanitarian needs in this area have remained high since before 2019 as a result of the mass intercommunal violence, induced displacement and related humanitarian and protection needs. There's been widespread food insecurity and malnutrition. They've been struggling with the drought over there. They've got disease outbreaks such as acute water diarrhea, mainly due to poor washing facilities. And it's just a highly complex humanitarian situation over there. So why is this relevant to the UK Fire and Rescue Service? Well, as a member of UK International Search and Rescue, UN OCHA is one of our key partners. And again, sometimes it's nice to zoom out and get the context within which we sit and how we help the cogs of this big machinery turn to help in the coordination of those humanitarian affairs. Today's episode was brought to you by our good friends over at William Wood Watches, the British watch brand made from upcycled firefighting materials in dedication to the founder's late grandfather. If you head over to the website at williamwoodwatches.com, you will see that in the last week, they have gone live with their new bronze amethyst watch. This is a stunning piece commemorating their 5 years. 5 years William Wood Watches has been going now. It was named amethyst after the gemstone of the month that they were incorporated, and they've got that cutout number 5 with the indication, the tribute of their 5 year celebration. So head on over to williamwoodwatches.com and have a look. Always remember that by supporting William Wood Watches, you are supporting the Firefighters Charity UK, Tunnel to Towers Foundation, and the Brush Fire Relief Fund. William Wood Watches has given over £75,000 to these causes, and you can support them too, as well as getting yourself a beautiful piece of fire service history right there on your wrist. So head over to williamwoodwatches.com to take a look. And a final request from me before we jump into the podcast today, just hit that subscribe and or follow button in front of you. It's a really important indicator so we can track how well each episode is doing. It'd be a massive favor to us, and it helps us bring you more interesting guests from across the world of the emergency services. So without further ado, let's get into it with today's episode with Sebastian Rose-Tamper from UN OCHA.
I was looking at some of the work that OCHA are involved in at the minute, and obviously as part of UKISAR, we kind of get some of the updates on some of the disasters that are going on out there at the minute. So we've got some work going on in Afghan at the minute. There's 459,000 people that are getting the support of food and winterization packages, and there's the Madagascar stuff that we had sort of kick off a couple of weeks ago. How do you see the work of UKISAR, the capacity building stuff? We spent some time with Humanity and Inclusion in Kosovo. Give us a little bit of an understanding of how those Lego pieces fit together to support the wider work.
It's a really complicated environment at the moment. There are a whole heck of a lot of disasters and protracted crises and complex emergencies. Shooting wars, interstate, intrastate. Ukraine's kicking off at the moment. It's a complicated world, and what we do is two things principally. We provide response services to a sudden onset disaster. So I've got teams in Madagascar. I've got teams just coming back from an oil spill, an environmental emergency in Peru. I've got teams out in the Philippines. I've got teams out in Tonga. And of course, we're doing our contingency planning should the worst happen in Ukraine, which I very much hope it won't. We do a lot of preparedness nowadays. And if you want a successful response, you need to do a lot of work in preparedness. And where UKISAR come into this is in the International Search and Rescue Advisory Group, FOLD, the family, the extended family of 58 classified teams now, light, medium and heavy. And they work with counterparts in Kosovo, they work with counterparts elsewhere to build capacity to ensure that local capacity, which is the first people who deal with any of these emergencies, is there when it's needed. It's a bit more complicated than that, and I can go into it in detail, but that's it. It's giving back, really, and it's a really, really important thing to do. People look to the UK, even now, as a reliable partner, a historical partner, and a trustworthy partner, and I think UK ISTAR is doing its bit to make sure that remains the case.
It's an incredibly difficult thing to get itself on the ground because it's such a large body of people. When we talk about the heavy and the light rescue teams to actually get them there. You spoke about the local capacity, which is obviously the first boots on the ground, the ability for nations and organisations that sit within them to be able to support their emergency services on the ground. But that's often the first line of defence that falls over. What are some of the challenges that you face regularly when it comes to understanding what support they need? Because, you know, from communications going down to local fire and rescue and police and security forces, you said about kicking off in certain aspects of the world. How on earth do you begin to navigate both the security aspect of it, the humanitarian aspect? Because we've got a lot of willing people, like you've got UK ISTAR, you've got all the other organisations that want to be there. They want to be there. They've got the skill sets. We've got the support from people such as yourself. What are some of the biggest challenges in being able to get them on the ground?
No, that's fair enough. I mean, I think for sudden onset natural disasters, collapse, structural rescue, that sort of thing, INSERAG's valuable, and being a member of that family is valuable because it's an internationally recognised standard. You've got the patch on.
Yeah.
Governments who need or want your support know exactly what they're getting. They know you're going to work to a certain standard within the guidelines. Your marking drills and skills are going to be the same. Your cutting and shoring is going to be the same as prescribed in the guidelines. So to all intents and purposes, they are getting exactly what it says on the box, and that makes them much more comfortable to make the request. There'll always be politics in it, and they may be happier to request a team from the Americas or Asia or Africa rather than Europe, where the majority of our teams are, although the UK is not in Europe anymore. I think that's the thing. We don't wait for people to request anymore. It's not the old days where you say, you know, look, you've had a terrible disaster, you've got to ask for help, because that's not what good neighbours do. We make, on behalf of the INSERAG community, on behalf of the 58 teams, we make the offer early. I mean, the great thing about INSERAG is we've got a policy and operational focal point in every member country, and that's, you know, the vast majority of the countries in the world. And they're in touch with us, and we're in touch with them as soon as something happens. And we say, look, if you need a hand, need a couple of light teams for just to supplement what you've already got, or if you've got a serious collapse structure incident, you need a heavy team, you need a couple of medium teams. We're there. We'll bring in the dogs. We'll bring in whatever you need. We won't stay any longer than you need us. And as soon as the job's done, we're gone. There's no money involved. You don't owe us anything. When it happens to us,
is that a concern? Then is there still those? And I don't want this to become a political conversation, but you really need the help to be there as quick as humanly possible. That 72-hour window really is when things can debilitate very, very quickly if that support's not on the ground. But there must be so much fear and apprehension from some partners as to what is it going to mean if I accept help from X?
There is. And the local emergency services are essentially saying, this is bigger than us. And that's a big call for a on-scene commander or you know, at the national level, strategic commander to make. I mean, you know, it goes through bronze, silver, gold very quickly, and then it's a political decision, and sometimes it can stall as a political decision. The good thing is we've got enough people now involved in INSERAG, aware of INSERAG at the political level, that they're much more likely to pull the trigger and say, okay, look, this is bigger than us. We'll accept 2 or 3 teams, 15 teams. Look, if San Francisco falls over, it's going to be an interesting one. You've got mega cities sitting on fault lines, Metro Manila, Jakarta, Istanbul. You know, the list goes on. It's
we
not
said
just,
to when we're speaking with Humanity and Inclusion, I think it was Zoe said, there's these areas that are habitually now, we recognise there is going to be repeated issues, not issues, but there's going to be repeated challenges that they're going to face just because where they sit geographically on those fault lines. And we need to have a good relationship with them. That's why we need to do this capacity building, because we need to be able to get on the ground. The likelihood of them being able to rebuild and restructurize their emergency services between these, they're happening so regularly now, it almost seems that they're perpetually going to be in that state, perhaps.
And that's where past response, it's really important to do the sort of thing you've been doing in Kosovo, where you are supporting the capacity development of the local emergency services, local USAR, because you know, they will be the first people there. During COVID, quite often they were the only people there because nobody could get in. So, you know, it's a very valuable service. Now, what I hope going forward, and I know UK at the policy level supports this, and I'd be surprised if it wasn't the same at the operational level, is that we try and be a bit more flexible in the support we offer. I tell you what, let's take an easy one. Australia and New Zealand tend to respond to collapsed structures, but okay. They also do fires, they do floods, they do winch rescue, they do water rescue, because, surprise, surprise, they're in the middle of bloody nowhere. There's nobody coming to their help other than, yes. than the other one. The Europeans, conversely, they've got a modular system.
Yes.
So they have the luxury of dedicating urban search and rescue teams, and that is what they do. They do collapse structure only. If you want, if you want forest fires, if you want water rescue, if you want whatever, that's a different module.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the problem here is that, yes, earthquakes are deadly, but they happen fairly rarely. We're being hit by storms and the like more often. So I'm trying to encourage the network, and there's a little bit of resistance from some partners, to think about how we can operate in a... Look, in 2019, I was in charge of the UN response in Mozambique. Massive storm, 15,000 odd people dead, a lot of people trapped. Mm. I needed roads cleared, I needed boat rescue. And I'm not talking about quality boat rescue. I'm talking about getting an inflatable, sticking a motor on it, and saving hundreds of people.
The thing is, when people over here themselves. Perhaps hear that, we're sat in London at the minute on the side of the Thames, they may think, we need level 6 or we need marine level, whatever. We're saying, no, this is a capacity that, with the greatest of respect, probably the majority of UK Fire and Rescue Service and UK ISR members have the capacity to deliver.
Absolutely, and in the same for route clearance to the principal hospital, it's a question of the same cutting and equipment.
It's chainsaw operators, it's lifting and moving. It's your basic USAR 1, USAR 2.
But there is a problem here. There's a fly in the ointment, and that is that we have spent 30 years, in strength 30 years old this year, developing clap structure search and rescue standards, and they are superb.
We are good at it as well. Our breaking and breaching, our shoring, we are very good at it. We enjoy it.
We're brilliant at it. But when you say to the team, I want you to get involved in more general response, they quite rightly worry that that will compromise the quality standards.
Yeah, they don't want to dilute it. I can appreciate that. There's an error about that.
You know, but we've got to... I mean, I'll tell you what, for nothing, and that is that ISR is not cheap. There's not a search and rescue team at the heavy level, medium or frankly even light, that's cheap. The reclassification and classification process that INSERAG demands is an expensive process. Okay. Governments want to see bang for buck, and I won't name the country, but you've got a country that's spending well over £2 million on its urban search and rescue capability, and it hasn't deployed it in 10 years. That's a European country, and it's not great. I mean, the government's not seeing bang
for
buck.
That's a hard thing for them to justify, yeah.
Yeah. What I would argue is that your command and control component in a USAR team, your medical component in a USAR team, your logistics component in a USAR team, can be used to support broader operations. They can. And we have all got to... learn from
I've
the
seen
Australians
a lot of that.
Kiwis.
Sorry, just to double click on that diversification. When we've been doing some regional stuff in the UK, some of our exercises, we've seen a much heavier involvement of our medical capacity, of our canine capacity. So hearing when you speak about that diversification of skill sets, do you feel that's going to be a big lever in, not to say justifying, but to support the reclassification and support the continued efforts of UK ISR, we need to continue to offer a broader range of skill sets. Am I right? Am I hearing you right?
I think it's all about it's supporting the people we serve. And if you can provide the diversity of skill sets,
know the customer's needs.
It's a no-brainer. If I put out a request for a UCC, a coordination cell to coordinate whatever, and I'm told by a country, it comes with all of the other four elements of USAR, I'm not really going to be that interested. I need the flexibility.
Yeah.
Now, the really interesting thing, I mean...
You want to pick and choose in the sweet shop. You want to say, no, I just need this, or I just need that. I don't want
what
all
we
of
need
the...
for the emergency. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
No, another easy one is that the UK's been a leading voice in developing our DAC concept, which is the Damage Assessment Coordination Cell.
Mm.
And this is just a no-brainer. This is using structural engineers and USAR specialists to say that critical infrastructure is usable or not, but not actually saying it themselves, advising local authorities to say it. So I go to Beirut. The two critical care hospitals are closed because people think they're going to fall down.
Yeah.
Have eyes on that. Get a decent structural engineer in. Advise the local authorities that is safe to use and should be used and opened as quickly as possible.
That's been a real move. I think we had three on each of the last deployments. We had two at Manchester, I think at Kimverstone. We had them as well. And they really were an asset. Bringing in those partner organisations really empowers us to have the knowledge on the ground rather than us having our best understanding of the structure of a building.
But then again, all that said, all that diversification and flexible response type thing, there will still be, I bet my bottom dollar on it, there will still be a massive urban search and rescue operation within the next 10 years. And I'm talking big. I'm talking the Metro Manila earthquake. You know, that's 22 million people living on a lot of reclaimed land with very bad building codes and standards. I think the local authorities are sort of well prepared as they can. There were some comedy areas. They put their urban search and rescue stockpiles, they stilled them under bridges, which of course pancake as soon as something happens, so you've lost your kit. But I mean, you know, they learn, and I think they're in a good position now to respond. But yeah, it's because they've been working with INSERAG and working with foreign teams, as well as building their own capacity, that they're there. So look, we've been around for 30 years, we'll be around for the next 30, we'll keep on growing. Yeah. You'll see less European teams. You'll see more and more teams coming up in Africa. Anything that the UK, and I was with the FCDO yesterday talking about this, anything that you can do to train and equip and bring...
That training aspect is a big one. Like you say, there's a way that we can utilise those skill sets that we're so proud of to help support the development of other teams. We spoke about some mentoring and stuff that we're doing as part of the INSERAG accreditation. We are committing those individuals to that, but we also need to turn the mirror on ourselves a little bit and think about how we can be better prepared for, again, without repeating ourselves, a more diverse range of emergencies.
Well, I'll be going to the Qatar team leaders meeting. We'll have our team leaders meeting in Qatar coming up next month. I'm looking forward to that. It's going to be one of the first times we've got everybody together. We'll be talking about how we're going to run operations this year. The Africa, Europe and the Middle East chair is Turkey. So AFAD is the chair of INSERAG. They're very, very strong. We've been approached by the Afghan authorities to try and build up their capability. It's going to be an interesting one working with the Taliban, but they're not the same Taliban they were. They're a different Taliban.
Yep.
And I'm perfectly happy building their disaster management response capability. That's something I have no worries doing. It's going to be an interesting one. I don't have many Pashtun speakers, but I'll find some. We've finally managed to start doing reclassifications. I was out in Far East Russia a couple of months ago doing the Far East Russia team heavy classification. Then we did a light, medium and a heavy, our first light classification in Switzerland, the German team. So no, it's an interesting time for us.
It's incredible to see everybody coming back to the floor after we've had this 2 years of... Yeah. Everyone's not been able to be out and about and connecting with their teams and continuing their professional development. It's great to see everyone's coming back to the floor, because there's so many things now where people may argue these resources may be better applied, or they may say, you know, we need to focus on staying safe at home. We know we're very good at that, and it's really important that we don't allow this to fall by the wayside now that we're hopefully past a little bit of this pandemic now.
Well, we developed standards for response in a pandemic. We particularly developed the INSERAG's medical working group came together and developed guidelines for working in a pandemic environment, which were both about protecting the operators but also protecting the victims that you're trying to pull out. And I think that was really useful. I'd say about the pandemic, the scope and scale of disasters determine whether or not governments were going to say in you come, and where it was big enough every time they said in you come, with one exception, and that is in the Pacific. If you think in 1918-19 the influenza pandemic wiped out half the Pacific Islands, they've got a good reason to be very, very careful. But again, there aren't many structures in that part of the world that could collapse and utilise our type of skills.
Yeah.
There's no deep rescue there. There's no five-storey, six-storey, seven-storey. Two stories about
very
here.
Small structures, yeah.
So there we're doing community-based search and rescue training. Mm. They've got a very capable Coast Guard. They've got a pretty capable fire service throughout the islands in Tonga, Fiji, Samoa, Vanuatu. So they're all right. There's a case in point again for flexible response. When New South Wales Fire Brigade or Queensland Fire Brigade or the Wellington Fire Brigade deployed from Australia and New Zealand respectively, they're deploying very small, very tailored teams to achieve a particular effect. And that could be 2-3 people, it could be 20-30 people. But again, flexible response. They're only deploying what the Samoans or the Fijians or the Vanuatuans are asking for, and it could be technical search, it could be thermal imaging, it could be something they don't have on island that those fire brigades can provide under the INSERAG rubric, and that works.
So it's quite a well-navigated, effective relationship that they've managed to develop between each other.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Sebastian.
Not at all.